7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back, Croc Nation, to yet another podcast. I am here with Angel Santana on my left. Happy Saturday, Angel Santana.
I tell you, it almost feels like deja vu yet again.
Exactly. Well, what Croc Nation doesn't know is we're doing a little double dipping today. We're actually doing a twofer with our four special guests from around the world. Last week, if you were smart enough to tune in to hear our episode on shared decision making, then you've met Dr. Len Berry, Dr. Karina Stephenson, Karina Oling, and Dr. Dawn Stacy from around the world. Len from Texas A&M, Karina from the University of Southern Denmark, and of course, Dawn from University of Ottawa. Today, as you heard from our introduction, our system is broken, Angel. The United States oncology system is not perfect. It is unfortunate, and I see this in my daily practice, how patients are delayed in getting their diagnosis, getting their news, getting in to see their consultants, getting in to see their specialists, getting their treatment plans done and get rocking and rolling. Sometimes could take not days, not weeks, but sometimes months. There is a lack of communication between providers. There is difficulty with accessibility to care and accessibility to your providers. There's also difficulties in your interactions with your providers, and we sort of explored that last week as we launched that module, shared decision making, and the improvements that we need to make in that regard, as well as involving our nurses more to be leaders in your decision making and help advocate for you. And lastly, add that advocacy. What we need to do as providers, as oncologists, as nurses, what we need to do for you after hours, what we have to do to make sure you have food on your table, that you're able to pay your bills, that your children are being cared for, that the other aspects of your life, that you're not being discriminated against at work, all the other things that we have to do, that it is our obligation ethically to do for our cancer survivors. We're going to start today's podcast with an old friend. This is now his third podcast with us. Angel, you better be careful, or he might start asking for money. We better watch out. Dr. Len Berry, professor from the University of Texas A&M. Len, you've spent an entire career studying and evaluating deficiencies in the systems, not just in medical field, but in other things. Looking at patients as consumers, which is exactly what they are and what they're deserving of. I think the old model, at least the American model, is, hey, you know, you're a patient, you come in, you be seen when you get seen. If you have to wait 4 hours in a waiting room, you know, that's your problem. You know, bring a book. You know, you come into buildings that are not really, you know, designed properly for your needs. Your care is not optimal. The whole system is just not right. And you spent a career sort of studying this and evaluating this. So I'm going to start off with you, my friend.
Well, thank you, Tom. We can do a lot better. There's a huge difference in the United States in oncology, but in other medical specialties as well, of course. But there's a huge difference between what we do and what we can do. A huge difference between the quality of service in healthcare in the United States and the quality of service in healthcare that could be. And so, yes, I've devoted much of my career to studying how to close that gap between what we are and what we could be when it comes to serving patients better. In terms of cancer, one of the issues, Tom, that you mentioned is the issue of waiting. And when you have a cancer diagnosis, waiting is suffering. When we think of suffering, typically we think of physical suffering. And of course, there's that too. And I don't mean to discount that. But there's also emotional suffering that comes with a diagnosis of cancer, a great deal of fear, uncertainty, anxiety. It's I've written about the notion that cancer care is a high emotion service, a high emotion service. And what I mean by a high emotion service is a service in which just the anticipation of receiving the service creates a great deal of emotional and anxiety and intensity. And so there's too much waiting in cancer care. But there's reason for optimism. There are some innovative practices that are happening in certain cancer clinics around the country that are minimizing the issue of waiting. And I'll just mention one and then turn it back to you and to my colleagues. But in terms of attacking the twin issues, both of which are major issues in terms of the opportunity to improve cancer care, number one is the issue of waiting. And number two is the issue of fragmented care, of uncoordinated care. In terms of attacking those two issues, there are some cancer centers in the United States today that offer their patients what's called typically a multidisciplinary clinic. And what a multidisciplinary clinic is, it's a all-day appointment for the patient and for family members of the patient, if the patient wants family members there. It's an all-day appointment, typically within 1 week of the cancer diagnosis. And that all-day appointment, the patient and the family are put in a conference room, and one by one, members of the cancer team that are going to care for that patient come to visit the patient and family. So the radiation oncologist would make a visit if radiation is going to be part of the treatment. The medical oncologist, if chemotherapy is going to be part of the treatment. The surgeon, if surgery is going to be part of the treatment. The nurse navigator, perhaps a dietitian, perhaps a financial counselor to help with the financing issues. And all of that happens in one day. These people have met before the patient visit. So in what's called a tumor board, where they have reached a consensus on this particular care plan, this particular patient. And so the team, the cancer team is in concert with what they think this patient needs, but then they start hearing the patient's voice and start learning what the patient prefers and start learning more about the patient as a person, not just as a patient, as a cancer patient, which gets into the topic we covered last week in shared decision-making, learning more about what the patient's values and preferences and concerns are. So this particular concept, this multidisciplinary clinic day, this whole day, where the patient and the family meet all the members of the team, and they present at the end of the day, they're able to present after hearing the patient's voice and knowing what the patient wants, they're able to present a cohesive plan of care, and the patient will leave with a written plan of care and with the next set of appointments already made. So all of this happens in the first week after diagnosis. When it's done well, and it's not easy to do well, it's beautiful. I've studied it at several different cancer centers in the United States, and it's beautiful. And it attacks two of the biggest service quality downfalls, in my view, that we have in U.S. cancer care.
With these deficiencies notwithstanding, I think, Len, that's an ideal model that we strive for. But I would think that's more of the exception than the rule at this point.
It is, but it doesn't need to be. That's my point that I started with, Tom, is the gap between what is and what could be in cancer care. We have to take care of the patient's clinical suffering. We also have to take care of the patient's emotional suffering if we're going to really be brilliant in the way we deliver care. Let me ask Don and also the two Karinas if anything like the model I've just described exists in either Canada or in Denmark.
Thanks, Len, for describing that ideal model. And one of the key features I find is it's very patient family centric. The healthcare system is organized around the patient and family rather than the system organized around the physician schedule or the oncologist schedule. I have heard of this happening in Edmonton, Canada, for people diagnosed with advanced cancer, where the palliative care team has that type of setting where they interact with the patient and family over the course of a half a day or a day. But at the same time, in fact, the patient and family are put into a comfortable space where if the patient's tired and needs a rest between the consults, that can also happen. So that's the only system I'm aware of that's done it. And I'm not even sure if they're currently doing it, but I know that they've done it in the past and it was described as ideal.
Karina O?
I'm not aware of anywhere in Denmark where they have that model. Are you, Karina S? Have you heard of...
That depends on what we are exactly discussing, because I think we have that everywhere. If we're thinking about the cancer package, because we are national, we do have a national tax-funded healthcare system where all patients are provided with equal access. And we have general practitioners. So every person in Denmark, they have a GP. So if they experience some kind of symptom, they contact their GP. And if their GP has any reasonable doubt whether this patient have some kind of cancer, he referred the patient to a cancer package, is what we call them. And then the cancer clock starts. So within 2 days, they need to be seen at the hospitals. Within 4 days, they need a CT scan. Within 6 days, they need a biopsy. This is Danish law.
No, and I love every, that. That is amazing. That's exactly
every single hospital, they report on a monthly basis to one of the five regions where they're based about how many days for all patients referred before they were seen, before they were biopsied, before they were scanned. And this is sent to the Central Healthcare Administration. And the numbers are provided in public. So we are tracked, and it's law that they have to be seen within a certain amount of days. And we have nurse coordinators that help patients coordinate their care. So this is guidelines.
Oh, no, I love it. That's Dawn, I wanted to ask, is Canada similar?
Yeah, so the Canadian system is publicly funded at 100%. We have no private cancer care services. And similar to Denmark, we have guidelines of practice and that the patients need to have been seen within a certain period of time, surgery within a certain period of time, and started on chemotherapy within a certain period of time. And so we also have a very clear cancer specialty system where they do follow these Canadian guidelines.
No, this is amazing. Len, boy, they really got it, right? That is absolutely perfect. How about communication between providers? Karina S., you know, the GP, you know, talks to you about a woman with ovarian cancer that they believe the patient comes to them with ascites and, you know, a pelvic mass, and they do a scan and the scan shows this big ovarian mass. You know, talk me through that. From when you see the patient, you know, what is the process with your communication between yourself, the GYN oncologist, the radiation oncologist, and the primary care doctor? How is that? Do you have good access to your colleagues?
Yes, we do. I think Len brought it forward. So we have tumor boards, or we call them MDT conference, multidisciplinary tumor boards. So every time a patient is entering into the system with a suspicion of ovarian cancer, for example, every Tuesday and Thursday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., I discuss all the newly referred patients or any other problematic patients with my colleagues actually at my neighbor hospital through video conferences. So we have on board, there are OBGYNs and me as a clinical oncologist and the radiologist and the, you know, the PET CT people and the nurse coordinator and the pathologist. So we sit probably 10 people in the room discussing all the newly referred patients and planning what to do with them. And when we're talking shared decision-making, actually, I think Karina Olin would probably say, who's missing in the room?
Yes.
Maybe the patient.
Ah.
So we are making plans for the patients, 10 people discussing this patient's case. And of course, we bring it forward to the patient afterwards, and we're busy. We'll be discussing 20 patients at the MDT conference. But I know some of my colleagues in ear, nose, and throat specialty, they have brought the patients inside the MDT conference.
Len, do you know of any similar models in the States? I don't.
No, there's a real fear of bringing patients into the tumor board. And there's logistical issues too, because a typical tumor board is going to have, as you know, Tom, take place between 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. before everybody, all the physicians and other clinicians start their day, their practice day. And so you might cover 10 patients or even more in that hour. And so there's a logistical issue where a particular patient might be discussed for 10 minutes of that time or even less. But the model that I describe, the multidisciplinary clinic model, where the members of the team come in one at a time and meet with the patient and the family, that model actually is kind of a mini tumor board. You just have, you have these multiple conversations from these different slants, whether it's a surgery slant or it's a chemotherapy slant or whatever the particular person from the medical team is charged with doing for the team, for the patient. So you hear the patient's voice throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, you change the treatment plan as necessary based on all the input you get from the patient that day.
Gotcha. So Len, the clinics that you study are most likely tertiary care centers, big centers. Karina, you're at an academic institution, as I'm sure Dawn as well. So you're at institutions where pretty much you have a lot of the major players. There's good communication between your colleagues and yourselves. What happens in Europe? What happens in Canada when a patient is in one of the more rural areas and they need, just say, a tertiary care opinion, a secondary opinion? Are they able to get access care to you guys from the periphery?
So in Canada, the cancer specialty programs are centralized around large cities. So I live in Ottawa, Canada, and so we in Ottawa have the cancer specialty services. So we have patients that can travel 2 to 3 hours to be able to come in to have a consultation. We do, though, have accommodation for them where they can stay within the lodge that's associated with the cancer services for very low prices compared to having to stay in a hotel. And we do try to facilitate after that original consult that if the treatment is chemotherapy, for example, we do have areas within the outlying more rural hospitals, rural located hospitals, where they are also could be delivering the chemotherapy as prescribed by the oncologists in Ottawa. And so we do try and bridge that distance, but definitely we have patients traveling long distances to get in to specialty care.
How about in Denmark? Are your patients speed skating in from the periphery? Are they cross-country skiing into the major centers, into the major cities? All kidding aside, do they have access to the bigger centers?
Well, I think we're still quite a small country, a mini put country with a queen and everything, and only 5.6 million inhabitants. So we don't have very long distances. I think everybody would be within an hour and a half to the closest central hospital. And cancer care in Denmark has been quite centralized. Before I treat patients with ovarian cancer, we were discussing ovarian cancer. Nowadays, with all the hospitals in Denmark, you can only have surgery in 3 or 4 of those. because to make sure that we have qualified care on a great level, cancer care is centralized by law. So you can practice oncology at a rural hospital because the national health care says that you can't, you need to travel. So some patients, they do need to travel, but we provide them with transportation. So they're being picked up by a cab, and probably we could do that much more because that's, I said, embarrassed in the other podcast. I'm also embarrassed when I go to the lobby at the hospital. There are always like 30 patients waiting in the lobby to be picked up from a public cab service. And they ride maybe two or three patients in the same cab together, not during the COVID-19, but now. So as usually it's when you go on a charter trip as a tourist, and you know that bus that picks you up and drop you off at hotels, you can sit in the bus for 3 hours because you have to go from hospital to hospital like cattle. And I think that's, we can do much better there. It's that's not good enough.
Yep, Karina. Oh.
Yeah, I just want to say that I agree with you, Karina, because I think that both in Canada and Denmark, we have pretty much control over some of the macro level elements of the healthcare system. The fundamental rights of the patients is good and everything. But I think there's room for improvement. And that's one of the examples, Karina. Also, you've made a really, really interesting paper, Len, about clues in healthcare. What are the clues that patients see when they come at our hospitals? As an example, I don't think it's more than 2 years ago that the patient's lists of appointments in the Department of Oncology, it said a doctor's appointment. Why is it a doctor's appointment? Why isn't it a patient appointment? There's some consultations rooms that's where the patient sits and the computer are between the patient and the doctor and the nurse, for example. So I think there's always still room for improvement on the micro level and the clues we have to be aware of.
Right. So, Tom, if I can interject here, I've been fortunate to visit Denmark a number of times and work with the two Karinas in my own research, and their cancer hospital in Vejle, Denmark. I've studied at a lot of different cancer centers in the United States, some of the most prestigious, some that are not as prestigious, but are really, really good. But I have never studied at a more humane cancer hospital than the one that the two Karinas work at. And so I wonder if we could get the two Karinas to talk about what makes their cancer center so different from some of the issues and problems and shortcomings we've been talking about in this podcast? Because it is to visit their cancer center, Patients Cancer Hospital, at part of Lillebot Health System, it's just a remarkable place. It's beautiful. Beautiful service that they provide, even despite all the shortcomings that the Karinas have mentioned that they want to improve on. What I saw there was better than what I'm used to seeing in studying cancer in the United States. So, Karinas, what's the difference? What do you have going for you? What's the secret sauce in Vejle?
I think we probably think the same, Karina Olling, but I will let you have the word first.
Well, I think that actually sometimes it's kind of difficult to see what we do that's differentiates us from others. But I think that one of the things that started the way that we think at Lillebælt Hospital is our former, what do you call it, CEO of the hospital, who actually visited hospitals together with a bunch of people among you, Karina, also in the States, and I think you were also in Canada at that time. And then when you came back, you made a program that should create the Patients Cancer Hospital. and some of the elements of that cancer hospital, the elements of the cancer hospital was built on patients first. And that patients first philosophy is not something that they say. It's actually something that they have managed to drip down all the way through the system, through all the layers. If you ask anyone at the hospital, not just physicians and nurses, but also the cleaning lady or the technicians, they know what the vision of this hospital is, and that is patients first. And I think that mindset also is something that our patients experience. I remember some patients who have talked about being treated at other hospitals for another disease, or and they say that it's kind of, they can feel it at the moment they walk in at the hospital. It drips down the walls or something. Was that what you were thinking about?
So beautiful, Karina. Thank you for sharing that. Karina S.
I couldn't agree more with Karina Olling. I think she said what is the core. It's something that's in the walls. It's about culture. It's about attitude. And it's about leadership. I think we had some very visionary leadership at the hospital who saw that this is how we want to run our hospital. The hospital is not made for the sake of the staff. The staff is, of course, supposed to have a great working environment, and we do, because if your patients are happy, then you're happy. So I think it's about leadership. And I think the leadership maybe 20 years ago saw that we want to be a patient-centered hospital. It's not patient engagement and patient centeredness and shared decision making. It's not ticket box. It is something, it's not something that we say, it is something that we practice. And I think they managed to communicate that very on a clever wise to all staff, not only physicians and nurses, but as Karina said, it's also to the porters and to the secretaries and the one who takes the telephone. So what can I do for you today? Instead, why are you disturbing us? Of course, that's not what we're saying to the patients, but it's something in the culture.
Dawn, I was wondering, I know obviously you're in Ottawa, but you know, you have great influence and information from other parts of Canada. Do you kind of feel similarly?
So in Canada, we've been working at shared decision-making for a very long time, but haven't been able to get it implemented like they have in Denmark. And so I often reflect back to find out what's going on in Canada. And so I think some of the challenges is that we have each province or territory has its own health system. So we have no national health system. It's a little bit similar to what happens in the United States, that each state has its own state-driven health systems, from my understanding. We also have provinces that have said they want patient first, just like Karina Olling said, and they've got documentation in Saskatchewan, the longest in Ontario where I live, and also in British Columbia, but they haven't put the behavior behind that statement. So they haven't really gone to achieve patient-centered care. And so I am really excited about what has been happening in Vejle in Denmark. And when I've gone to the hospital, I want to understand how did they change the culture. And I agree fully behind Karina S. that really it's around the leadership vision that they wanted this for everybody to have a change of culture to be patient first. And then this really set the fertilization and the rich ground to then bring in shared decision making. And it then fits because the patient's already is valued as an important member of the team and is already valued in terms of we need to provide care that's more centered on what their needs are. And so I would say this hospital is probably one of the few in the world that really has achieved this hospital-wide. And how I know that they've achieved this is Karina S. took me for a walk around the hospital, and she could stop anyone in any hallway or office and say, tell Dawn what you do around patient-centered shared decision-making. And they all were able to answer on the spot around how that they know what it is and how they live and breathe this as part of their everyday practice.
Len, that gives me hope.
Yes,
I wanted to ask the two Karinas while we were talking about, you know, the outstanding programs and the culture, we'll call it the culture, you know, of cancer care over by you guys. The above and beyond that I believe all five of us would agree that is necessary. If you're going to practice oncology, you can't just be great at what you do. You also have to, you know, extend yourself personally. Is that the thought process also in your program as far as advocating for their other needs, protecting them from discrimination, the things that we see in our cancer patients every day? You know, how are your thoughts as far as how you go above and beyond in your practices?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I'm not sure I
understand. We only ask the probing difficult questions here on the Crock Podcast.
I think we are trying, of course, it's much easier when all patients, no matter who you are, where you live, how kind of education you have, they have equal access. So you are at a much better starting point when you are treated equally, no matter who you are and what your income are. But of course, some patients need more help than other patients. And I think, Dawn, you talked about nurse navigators and nurse coordinators. And I think for some patients, especially nurses, can help them to get the treatment that they need, because otherwise they will have more difficulties getting the same treatment as the other patients, even in Denmark, because they are not, the health literacy is poor and they don't have IT skills and they don't show up to their appointments. So I think I can't remember who said it, but if you want to treat everybody equal, you need to treat them not equal.
Yes. I'm sorry, Dawn. Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to add, in Canada, we have also a number of nurses that are titled as navigators of the oncology care system. Cancer care is one of the only areas where we see this navigator role. And I think it's really important as well, another important role for nurses, because the cancer system is complex and there are a lot of different players, different team members on the people on your team. And I think it's an important role for nurses to be able to support patients through the system.
Yep, Karina.
And as you started by talking about waiting time, Len, if we could manage to transform waiting time into preparation time, give nurses a role in that in that situation, help patients be prepared to be a part of decisions, a part of the healthcare system, because they have to kind of embrace another role that they have in their everyday private life. So if we could transform the waiting time to something else more positive.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I'm actually thinking that maybe the systems are so different between our countries. What I was getting at specifically is, Len and I, it is not uncommon for us to see an American cancer survivor / patient go in, get a diagnosis of cancer, go into their job, and then be fired from their job because of the diagnosis of cancer, or them not getting insurance because of their cancer, or them being discriminated against in other ways. And that's why I asked that question. And it may be that those circumstances don't even exist outside of our country. It's possible.
Yes, Tom, I think one of the great tragedies of serious illness in the United States health system, not just cancer, but other serious disease, is that it often puts families into bankruptcy. It puts, cancer is one of the leading causes. That's a tragedy. That's a tragedy that is just inexcusable. And we need to fix that. It's bad enough to have cancer, but on top of that, to have the concern that cancer is going to bankrupt my family is simply unacceptable. And yet it's a reality in the US because of the way we pay for care. So, yes.
Actually, that's a good segue, Len. What I was going to say was a lot of the differences that we're seeing, the ideal world, both in your travels as well as with our friends from Denmark, you know, Canada, definitely better than us. But, you know, everything, I might be a skeptic and I might be a little jaded, but, you know, in our country, you know, everything starts with the fiscal, everything starts with the financial. And you've studied this, and I'm sure also Dawn has studied this as far as health reform and things like that. I'm just curious if that is the center of the problem, if it's not just the almighty dollar or you know, what are your thoughts as far as that, as far as the differences in our care systems and oncology patients being able to derive that same circumstance or experience that they would at the University of Southern Denmark as opposed to our cancer centers?
Yeah, do you want me to tackle that first, Tom?
Yeah, please, if you don't mind it, because, and again, that's worthy of a whole module itself. So I'm not expecting anything, comprehensive, but just, I think it's really operative here when we're comparing, contrasting different systems.
Yeah. One of my close friends who's chief executive officer of the Mayo Clinic. He's a surgeon, and I have him speak to my students every year. He likes to say, healthcare is a business, but taking care of a patient is not. Healthcare is a business, but taking care of a patient is not. And the meaning behind that statement is, patient first healthcare needs to be patient first healthcare, not financial first healthcare, profit first healthcare, revenue producing unit healthcare first. It needs to be patient first healthcare. And I admire countries such as Canada. And the European countries such as Denmark that have a system in which a patient who becomes seriously ill can have access and not feel any shame, not feel any financial burden, not feel like, well, my decision has to be if I take chemotherapy, it's going to cost so much, I'm going to bankrupt my family and I'm going to die anyways, therefore I'm not going to take chemotherapy. Which is a reality in American healthcare.
It is a clear reality, yes.
Yes. So I'll let my colleagues take it from there. But
actually, yeah. Before we get to you, Dawn, I want Angel to read. Karina S. just sent us a quote, which I think is perfect. That plays right into your statements about patient first.
So we received a quote here, and it says, that it was from Mahatma Gandhi, the patient is the most important person in our hospital. He is not dependent on us, we are dependent on him. He is not an interruption in our work, he is the purpose of it. He is not an outsider in the hospital, he's a part of it. We are not doing him a favor by serving him, he's doing us a favor by giving us an opportunity to do so.
Thank you, Angel. And I think really, Len, that's what's missing. You know, that's the secret sauce that's missing in our system, to be honest with you. And, and I appreciate your words. Dawn, I did not mean to interrupt you.
So I think given we're one of your closest neighbors,
yes.
We also have Mexico in the south, but we often compare our systems. And I think as Canadians, we're pretty proud to have a publicly funded system. But in the oncology care part of it, where we don't have equality is in reimbursement for medications taken at home. And one of the things I'm noticing in oncology is we're actually shifting to a lot more oral anti-cancer types of treatments. And these drugs then are falling as a burden on the patients and their families to have them funded. And some of these medications could be quite expensive per month. And so my view as a nurse, when I think about the cancer care system, is that when we have someone diagnosed and there's a decision around this is the best treatment, then my view is the supportive drugs and all of the cancer drugs should be actually included within that package of treatment that the patient then has access to. And so I think in Canada, we do have further to go in terms of how do we create a cancer care system that's actually more holistic, that includes the supportive care drugs and some of these new oral chemotherapy that's coming along. And I'd love to hear from Len around the whole shift to oral chemotherapy.
Yes, I envision more and more cancer care in at least in the United States, going into the home, Don. In addition to the oral therapeutics that you've mentioned, there's more and more interest in putting palliative care into the home, taking it from the hospital and putting it into the home, even chemotherapy in the home. And you know that at first blush, you think chemotherapy in the home, but you know if it's done properly with the proper supervision and overview, and preparation for the family to help, it could address an earlier issue that came up in this particular podcast, and that is how do we more effectively serve patients who live far away from the hospital? And the answer is potentially home care and beyond medication through other forms of home care as well. So I just think it's a positive, slow moving, but positive trend in the United States, Don, and that is more and more cancer care being done in the home when appropriate. Sometimes the patient needs to be in the clinic, of course, needs to be in the operating room, of course, but the patient doesn't always need to be in the clinic. The patient doesn't always need a doctor. Sometimes a nurse is not only as good, but is better than a doctor in handling a number of issues that come up in cancer care. And being in your home as a cancer patient with the kinds of emotional distress that comes with cancer, being with your family instead of in a hospital room, eating at your kitchen table instead of eating in your hospital bed. That's part of therapy too. That's part of helping people get well too.
Yep. Karina, you had your hand up. Yep.
Yeah. Just a small note. I think what you described there, Lynn, for choosing if you want to be home care or be in the hospital, that would be just a perfect preference sensitive decision to make together with the patient, which is your decision maker.
Fantastic. I want to just hit one more subject. I say this very sincerely. I could talk to you guys all day, honestly, but I know you guys have your Saturdays to get to. So I'm going to just use one last subject with the hope that you'll commit to another podcast in the future. But that's as far as how we as providers, how we position ourselves, how we represent ourselves with the patient. And I know that my colleagues, I tend to be an outlier in trying to bring a more informal relationship with the patient, you know, including dressing informally. I'm known for wearing sports jerseys, and the patients love it. When I don't, they get very upset. I'm known to be on a first name basis with my patients, create friendships and relationships. Certainly not inappropriately. We're not on the same bowling team, but I want them to feel loved and cared about. The first thing that I ask a patient has nothing to do with their cancer, but to Karina O's point, getting to know the patient, I ask them, what is their essence? What is it about them? And I just actually met a patient the other day who actually shared a meal with one of the popes, things that you wouldn't really think about, you know, things that you wouldn't know. I had a patient on Friday who was a professional hockey player who came from Canada. So there are really such great things to learn about our patients or for them to learn about us. In Canada, in Denmark, is it a more traditional, like in the States, where there's the white coat and there's that sort of separation, that fourth wall, or are things more informal and more of a relationship building than it is a doctor-patient dyad traditionally?
So thank you, Tom, for bringing this issue up, because I think it's really about how do we build trust with our patients? And in order to build that trusting relationship, there needs to be some honesty or just clarity around who's the real you that's in this and your commitment into this team. And so I think that although we still have the formal coats and anybody can wear whatever they want under them, so there can be some individuality in terms of what people wear, I think it has to do with sitting at eye level, looking at the patient, not at the computer where you're trying to fill in the blanks. I think there's a lot of things around talking about who you are, the patient is as a person, and how do we really build that trusting relationship?
Karina and Karina?
I really agree with you, Dawn. I think that's the, I was thinking trust before you even said the word trust. I think that's the most important thing, to create trust with your patients and their relatives. And it's about saying hello. It's about how you introduce yourself. It's about that I go to the waiting room and get the patients with me and not letting everybody else get the patient. It's how I sit in the room. It's the eye contact. It's the body language. It's all what Len would say, all the small clues and having the computer screen in the background or on the side and not between me and the patient, and having a table between me and the patients. So it's about design. It's about all those little clues that sum up on how you meet your patient.
Karina?
I totally agree with both Karina and Dawn. I think as a nurse, we are aware that our uniform, that it's rule that we have to wear our uniform form. And we can wear whatever you want for shoes or in your hair, earrings or what you want. But we are aware that that could be a barrier. So I think you can go really, really far with body language, with eye contact, as Karina said. And I think that's just what we have to work with. So putting yourself at the same level as the patient, with what you signal, with your body, with your words, that would be something that we have to be aware of when we use the uniform that puts us in kind of a box in the patient's mind.
You got, and again, when I first met you all off air, we were kind of talking about my history in cancer survivorship and advocacy that goes back 20 something years, and having some of those informal social events where there was an educational, product, where there would be a lecturer or something like that, or bringing in an expert, an insurance agent or an attorney, or whatever. It could be even a yoga master, or whatever. And in those moments, I think that's what built in me, at least, that power, that knowledge that there's some real good juice out there. And I believe, and I haven't proven it yet, but I believe there's also an improvement in outcome when the patients feel that their providers are vested in them personally, not just professionally. Are there events that you participate in as far as public lectures or events? We have the American Cancer Society. You might have some fundraisers or things like that. Do you participate? Oh, the Relay for Life we have in the United States. You guys participate in that on the personal side as well?
So in Canada, we also have Relay for Life and other sort of events that are usually centered around fundraising for the Canadian Cancer Society. And so I might participate as an individual who's participating in the event. But if I am invited to give a lecture, then I'm usually quite open to talking about sort of what's my area of research around decision-making or cancer symptom management, and then sharing that with the public. So I'm quite happy to do this. And I've actually done this in Denmark as well, where they actually work very closely with any events for healthcare professionals to also invite the patient representatives from the different cancer societies and other organizations.
Karina, do you enjoy that aspect of your personal / professional lives?
I think we do very much. Whenever we get the opportunity, we are more than happy to meet, the guests of our hospitals. And we also do that on research, bring patients in on as partners, as research. And in our Center for Shared Decision Making, we have 5 patients in our steering group. So we bring patients in as board members, but also meet, our users in meetings and seminars and events. So yes, definitely.
Karina?
Yeah, I agree. Actually, someone asked me once, isn't it a barrier to include patients in all of these contexts? Putting patients in the same room as clinicians, for example, when developing decision aids or making them participants in developing a project. And I think that if there are any barriers, the benefits of it is much larger than. So I wouldn't ever say that they shouldn't be a part of it.
Yeah, Len. As our relationship grows, that would be something I would love to collaborate with you. I would love to find out some kind of a metric or some way to judge or to determine or study whether those interfaces, those interactions, those relationship building events would actually translate to improved outcomes with our patients. There was one paper I read many years ago, believe it or not, came from a radiation oncology clinic. What is it that you want from your radiation oncologist, on the personal side? And that was really the lone paper that I've ever seen on that. So I'd love to collaborate with you on that end for sure. As I always do, I bring my friend Angel Santana to have the second to last word or third to last word.
One of the things that and thank you very much again for being here for another successful podcast. Len, you started off by saying what we do, what we can do. We were talking about, the waiting and the suffering. Then I started to hear more about the most popular phrase, which was patient first. And it jolted my memory on a movie, which was a line that was very popular, and it's attitude reflects leadership. And then I started to hear the word team. And I heard each and every one of you reference our hospital. When you think of all those attributes, when you think about everything that you've talked about today, that is the culmination and the blueprint of what patient is first should be. So I commend all of you for doing that. And I hope that someone that listens to this says there's something there. And doesn't matter where we're from, doesn't matter what we do. What does matter is that we need to be a team. And team is going to put patients first. So for that, I say thank you.
Yep. And I am going to challenge the four of you. Last time in the last podcast, I said, do you have any ending things to say to me? And then the crickets came out. So I'm going to challenge each of you to have one last remark as it relates to patient care in our different parts of the world. I'll start around the clockwise. Karina O, Karina S, Dawn, and Len. And you guys better have something to say.
Something to patients around the world. Yeah. Did you say that?
Please.
Yeah. Okay. This is not my core element. I think I would say that I think that wherever you meet healthcare professionals, I think they always want the best for you. And that doesn't depend of if they are in the American system, in the Canadian system, or European system. I think they have an education, and that they had that education for a reason.
You are a very wise woman for your age, young lady. Karina S.
I think if I were a patient myself, or a family member were a patient, and as a doctor also, I think I can't always decode what matters the most to the patients I'm sitting in front of. I think if I were a patient, I would really try to tell the healthcare professional how they could help me. I think we're not mind readers. So if we can better help each other, then please tell us as a patient, how can I best possible help us? What help you? What matters the most to you? So please don't be afraid to speak up. Tell your healthcare professionals how they can help you and what matters to you. Because we don't know if you don't say it.
Yes. Thank you, Karina. Dawn?
I think back to when my daughters were starting to be around 12 years of age, and when I would take them to the family physician, I would actually started getting them prepared for the visit. What is it from your perspective that you need to talk to the doctor about? And so I think my philosophy is that we need to support the public and patients to have a voice, but we also need to encourage them or invite them to also, because it is somewhat intimidating when you're entering into a system that you're not comfortable in. And I mean, it's more comfortable probably for me because I'm a nurse, but I think even as a nurse, when I have to go into a system like the cardiovascular system, I feel intimidated because it's not an area that I feel I have expertise in. So we need to be looking at how can we prepare them and how can they sort of take on that more active role in asking the questions.
Len, our system is broken, but I have confidence and I have absolute faith in the fact that we will catch up to Canada and catch up to Europe one day. What great examples from our great professionals from across the world. Your ending statement, please.
Well, thank you for having us, Tom. This was a very enjoyable conversation with you and with my friends, Don and the two Karinas, all wonderful clinicians. My closing comment would be based on my research and experience over the past 20 years in health services, is and particularly relating to cancer and other serious disease, is clinicians' kindness influences the patient's trust, and the patient's trust influences more positive outcomes, both medical/physical outcomes, but also better emotional outcomes.
I just want to take a minute as we end this podcast by thanking our guests, Dr. Len Berry, Karina Oling, Dr. Karina Stephenson, and Dr. Dawn Stacey for two amazing podcasts. We are so absolutely just so elevated by you guys. You've given our constituency really some great things to think about, some great information, some great advice. Very patient first stuff. And everyone, as you've said many times, you are deserving, everyone, Croc Nation, all of our cancer survivors, all of our patients in general. If you're listening to this podcast and you happen to not be a cancer survivor, but know a cancer survivor, you are also very deserving of such care, patient first care. Our thanks to Angel Santana, Have Faith, Let It Begin, Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up, Michael John Benzea, Charlotte Larson, our patrons from Hollywood. And as I end every podcast, every Croc podcast, with the following words, on behalf of Angel and our friends from around the world, we all wish you a very long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you, and we wish you peace.